So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
I don't know if coffee is the gateway to coke.
You tried?
It hasn't been for me yet.
Tried it with cocaine?
You mean that's... Imagine people took that instead of sugar. Mm-hmm. That would kill you.
Mankind, what do you have in store for Shawn Michaels?
Misery and destiny. You see, I live to make Shawn Michaels miserable. I live to make his clique feel the pain that I've known my whole life. You see, Uncle Paul has told me that it's my destiny to hear Shawn Michaels gurgle screams. It's my destiny to hear his liver rupture. It's my destiny to hold my hand aloft, Uncle Paul. Cuddle that heavyweight title. It's destiny. And after that, we'll all have a nice day.
We're playing those mind games together. Pushing the barrier. Planting seed. We all been playing those mind games forever. Some kind of druid dude lifting the veil.
It is Review Away with John Pollock and Wei Ting, the departing Wei Ting. This is his swan song.
That's right. I might be gone forever.
You could be gone forever.
I am gone forever. I'm done. This is my last show.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, that would mean one of two things. Either something horrible happening to you, or you abandoning me, and I have abandonment issues with,
what if,
so don't play with those.
What if I go somewhere out of this country and I just happen to fall in love with whatever city I'll be commuting to and I decide to stay?
I'd call immigration on you. I'd make sure you were deported instantly and say that this guy is here without a visa. Kick him out immediately. Immediately.
Well, that'd be very selfish.
Yes, but I feel I'd be selfish, but I'd be serving the greater good of our listeners who would all be backing me.
Well, anyway, yeah, you know, it kind of hasn't really even sunk in yet that after this, I won't be doing any shows for 3 weeks. For people who aren't aware, I'm doing a bit of a work/vacation trip over the next month, so that'll kind of take me away from all these shows, unfortunately. But John has a bunch of guest hosts that I'm very excited for all the programs. So
I have like 9 mystery doors. Wait.
I know.
And I think I have people behind each and every door.
But I'm actually a little bit upset that, you know, I'm watching all this build up for Hell in a Cell, for, you know.
I thought you were going to say the World Series. But yeah, Hell in a Cell too.
Yeah. I mean, mainly because, like, even though, you know, we might not always enjoy Raw or SmackDown, I am somewhat invested at this point in all these storylines. I've devoted several hours into all these storylines. And to not really get to see them all pan out week to week, I feel
kind of
wrong.
You've been designing the new iPhone and you're going to miss the launch.
Yeah. So I guess I'll have to rely on listening to the shows to figure out.
Do you think you'll watch much wrestling over the next 4 weeks?
I honestly don't know how much access I'll have, especially for like Raw and SmackDown. I mean, everything's kind of... I can guarantee you I won't be watching all 3 hours of every Raw. I'll tell you that. So I think I'll do my best to keep up. But, you know, I'll listen to the shows, of course.
Yeah, you'll have to.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to miss me. You will, believe me.
I don't miss many people.
Once there's an ocean between us, Wei, you're going to be longing for the days of me nitpicking and transcribing promos on Raw that you can hear. That man, I heard from some people who actually, they thought it was a good promo, and then when they heard my rendition of it, thought, no, it was terrible. So maybe I did a disservice to this promo with Sasha and Roman.
You know what? I think that's kind of your duty, is to, like, it's like in They Live, you're the sunglasses, you know, in They Live. We get to see the real reality behind
it. That's what happens when I watch Raw. I see skeletons. I see... I just see through the promos. Well, Wei, I don't want to waste too much time. We are on the eve of Game 1 of the American League Championship Series as Toronto will be meeting Cleveland. We are
depending on when you're listening to this.
Oh, you know what? It's tonight.
It's tonight.
Yeah. It's tonight, yes. Thursday, had we done this on Thursday, I would have said on the eve.
Yeah.
And I don't want to go too political heavy here because that's what Review America is for. Brand new show up on Thursday.
Great analysis.
With Brian Mann and Nate Milton, who put this show out, and Brian has declared Donald Trump's campaign is dead. He has no way of winning this at all.
I don't know if there are many people that disagree.
Well, Thursday was not a good day for Donald Trump.
Oh, what happened?
A lot of women have come forward with different incidents involving this individual. Mm-hmm. It's not looking good for Donald Trump.
Yeah, unfortunate.
It's not looking good for him as just a human being with possible charges coming out of
this. I don't know what he was aiming to gain. With this whole...
The presidency.
I don't even...
I'm with you. I don't think he started this with the idea of winning.
No, I don't know.
You got to remember, he had just been axed from The Apprentice, which was his brand on NBC. He was excommunicated from NBC. He decided to throw his name into the hat, and it instantly got laughed out of the world that this guy had any prayer of being a real candidate. And as one Republican after another fell... Here's this fucking guy standing at the end of it as their nominee.
How bad were these other candidates that he ended up being the one they chose?
Bad enough that they didn't go. I mean, Jeb Bush was figured to be the favorite. They all, I mean, Ben Carson, I mean, this guy was just out there.
How did any of these guys not make it? And do you think any of those guys would have, obviously anyone else would have a much better chance than Donald Trump at this point?
You've got to look at it that when you are trying to attract voters... It's a performance, and whether you despise this man or not, he's an outstanding performer.
Sure.
Go watch the debate. Like, this guy is a great villain.
Watch him at WrestleMania.
You know what? He's better in this than he was at WrestleMania.
Oh, yeah,
nothing. Okay. He doesn't have to take a stunner at any of these debates. Though Thursday, I think, was a number of stunners he took. Maybe he wasn't stunned by them.
I'll definitely be keeping up with the election.
Lots of mind games in this election.
Yeah. I can't wait. But for more analysis and I'd say better coverage, far better coverage of the election than you and I could provide, do listen to Review America, which is, I think for my money, the best election coverage out there for wrestling fans.
I agree.
There's no better.
They had a great episode a few weeks back with MVP and Alex Greenfield.
Yep.
And this week, dissecting the latest with the leaked tape, Billy Bush.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff going on. But we've got In Your House to discuss. From September of 1996, we're going back 20 years, Mr. Ting.
It's the 20th anniversary, or at least it was a month ago. And so I think that's kind of what spurred the idea of doing this show. Or one of the more memorable In Your Houses.
This was a show that I think everyone remembers for the main event. This was one that for a long time Mick Foley outlined as the best match of his career up until the Randy Orton match in Edmonton at Backlash in 2004.
Which match do you think is better? I don't know if you remember the Orton one.
Oh, I remember it very well. I'd probably lead to the Orton match based on the finish, and it did a lot for Randy Orton in that match. I mean— This one was excellent, too.
Yeah.
If you want to nitpick finishes, that's the only place you can nitpick this match. But we will get into that. 15,000 people at the new Core State Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And that city is important for this show, being that it was 96 and a gate of $210,000 and $210,290. And we started this with a video package. Behold the Face of Fear. Mankind, and pray that this man can stop the insanity, as they show Shawn Michaels and this ominous voiceover by Todd Pettengill to preview The Undertaker and Goldust and the stench of betrayal left by Paul Bearer the prior month when he turned on The Undertaker to join Mankind. And throughout the night, we got to see the animated skull with Mankind's mask on it that read Mind Games on the forehead. So going overtime with the graphics package, and animation here.
It was like a reboot level type of computer graphics.
It reminded me of the little paperclip on Microsoft Word. That's what this little guy reminded me of.
Oh, really?
Same eyes.
Does that paperclip guy still exist?
I don't think so. I think he's...
long gone?
Yeah, he's bitten the dust.
He annoyed the shit out of me. Just sometimes just would not go away.
Well, a lot of times he would just point out obvious shit. Like, I know. Yeah. I know. I don't need this. Paperclip.
Switch to a Mac. That's what you should do. But
that's what he did.
What?
Maybe he got... I'm on a PC, so I don't know where he went.
But this was, I believe, it had all the characteristics of a David Sahadi joint of the 90s in the WWE. And I think watching it now, it is strangely reminiscent of what we see today in the Bray Wyatt promo. That similar type of big wording, very ominous sounding. And though I would say that with these little teasers, you have a much better understanding of what they're actually talking about because you can see the imagery. But I'll say if Bray Wyatt ever gets bored of wrestling, he maybe should start writing these teases. Might be a better use of his talents.
He could be the new Fred Blassie when you need a big epic pay-per-view opening. Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, and Mr. Perfect are the commentary team. An underrated three-man team, I thought.
I thought they were fine, yeah. I thought each kind of... you know, I'll say, like, I feel like JR and Vince kind of clashed a little bit.
Well, they were kind of designed to because this was right in the middle of the fake Razor and Diesel tease by Jim Ross, which would be revealed the next night on Raw. We would get a cameo of them, and Jim Ross being presented in that introduction of Diesel and Razor as this bitter man that has been fired repeatedly and hates Vince McMahon. So they were playing up that tension between these two.
Wow.
And really led nowhere. So they're doing their standard pay-per-view introduction in front of the audience who had a number of signs that were just all perfect, perfect penmanship.
Yeah, sure.
Too clean to be normal wrestling fan signs.
What are you suggesting?
That most of them are just sloppy and they don't look this neat.
No, what are you suggesting about these particular signs? Were they plants?
If you want to jump to that conclusion, I would join you.
What did these signs say?
Well, here were our signs. And once you read these, I don't know if you could necessarily say that they were from anyone other than people in the company. Tony Gurria rules. Vince McMahon for God, which is not a position anyone can run for. And this one, very 1996. Hey, Sonny, fat guys do it better. That one may have been rogue.
You think that was a company fan?
This was Philadelphia. I mean, this was an educated marketplace. So maybe they were aware of Tony Gurria.
Okay.
But hey, Sonny, fat guys do it better.
Maybe
welcome to 1996. And 1996 meant Justin Hawk Bradshaw and Uncle Zebekiah, who were out to take on Savio Vega, who I misspelled here as Savio Vegas, in a Caribbean strap match. Savio Vegas's specialty. And this was made on the free-for-all pre-show when Bradshaw interrupted Vega's previous match with Marty Jannetty. So this was a stip for about 20 minutes build. And Kevin Kelly was with Vega backstage, who just cut a spirited promo. And when mentioning the Caribbean strap match, Vega said, "You got it, stinky cowboy. And we've got a strap match."
Ooh. He said he also threatened to whip his butt.
Ooh. 96, we're getting edgy. Vega charges the ring and the match begins right away. And our referee is Downtown Bruno, Harvey Whippleman.
Oh, right.
Making his return. Back-to-back review aways. And in the front row, you can spot Paul Heyman, Tommy Dreamer, and the Sandman. And Vega yanks Bradshaw into the post by the strap on the floor. And then Sandman gets up and spits beer at Vega. And they were acknowledged by the announcers as a local wrestling group here in Philadelphia.
Things can really get dangerous out there. Look at this. Fabio Vega being choked by that strap.
opportunity. We're
going. Oh, wow. Wow.
Hey, wait just a moment. There's a local wrestling group here in Philadelphia, and obviously trying to make a name for themselves here. At the expense of the World Wrestling Federation. And we will not shoot this ugly incident that is occurring. But meanwhile, Savio Vega and Justin Ott Bradshaw are ignoring what's going on outside the ring, as well they should.
Some folks are doing a lot of things with their 15 minutes of fame.
Obviously trying to make a name for themselves at the expense of the WWF, and they take the cameras off them to not shoot it, and Ross states they're trying to get their 15 minutes of fame, and this was the pseudo relationship involving the WWF and ECW to work together here in Philadelphia. And going into this show, there was a concern of how much of this crowd would be, whether it be chanting ECW or cheering on Mick Foley in the main event, and they kind of gave that ECW contingent their fill here at the beginning of the show and then never referenced again.
Yeah, I thought it was presented rather well, especially for 1996. I thought they, you know, did it with a good subtlety that wasn't overdoing it, that really made you question, if you were watching at the time, whether or not this was legit. Because the cameras, like you said, didn't pay direct attention to it. You had to kind of watch all this action in the background of the match. Vince didn't call that much attention to it. So the way they handled it, I thought, was impressive for 96. I mean, I guess in hindsight, though, if you have the Sandman and Dreamer attacking Savio Vega and Bradshaw, it kind of just spells out how low card, mid card of an invasion it really is.
They overthought things, because you know what the tip-off was for a fan in 1996? Paul Heyman isn't springing for front row tickets. There's no way. And he was there in the middle, and then they'd follow it up with more the next night on Raw and an appearance by Taz. So that was all our ECW involvement for the night as the match continued.
How well do you remember this being coming across, like in the WWF at the time? What kind of a mark did it really make?
I think people got excited by it if you were familiar with who they were.
Right. And how many people were necessarily familiar with ECW that was part of the WWF audience?
I would say a small percentage at the time. Yeah. You're talking about newsletter readers and people that are following.
This was even certainly probably before ECW's big boom, right?
Yeah. I mean, they creatively, maybe their peak was 95, 96. But in terms of exposure, it was probably 97 and beyond. I mean, the big one everyone remembers was a few months after this when they did the Raw episode with ECW before Barely Legal. And I would say that was when more people became familiar with ECW, and they were available on pay-per-view as well to watch, because not everyone got the television at this time. So the match continues, and they continue as ECW and the guys are escorted out. Vega is whipping Bradshaw repeatedly. He gets to the three corners and gets yanked away from the fourth. He tries again, and he is ripped away, like just contorts in midair by Bradshaw yanking on the strap. And then Bradshaw hits a mild clothesline. This was not full clothesline from hell. This was like a clothesline from Pittsburgh.
Which is close to hell. But not really.
Oh, I didn't insinuate that way. That's awful.
It still looked like a pretty big clothesline. Not it wasn't used as his finish, but it was impressive enough that it drew a comment from Mr. Perfect.
And he's pulling Vega. And you won't believe this way. Sit back, okay? I hope that seat has your back support. Bradshaw would hit a turnbuckle, and then he didn't realize that Vega was behind him hitting the turnbuckles along the way. And then we got to the fourth one. And they have a tug of war, and Vega gets thrown from the throw into the fourth turnbuckle and wins at 7:08. But man, that creativity, a WWF strap match where the aggressor is pulling his opponent and he is secretly hitting the turnbuckle pads behind him. I mean, I've only seen this like 100 times in a WWF strap match, but man, was this amazing. And Savio Vega, they say, remains undefeated in strap matches with a 7-minute and 8-second match.
Well, this was his match, wasn't it?
This was Savio's match. They brought it up. He had beat Steve Austin earlier this year in the Caribbean strap match.
Well, perhaps it's the lack of creativity involved in a very limited gimmick like this that is the reason why we rarely see these types of matches anymore, because I certainly was not a fan of this particular match.
The Austin one was pretty good earlier in the year.
And how did he win? Or how did Savio win that one?
If I had to guess, it would probably be the exact same way.
Okay. Have they ever done a strap match for a six-sided ring?
No, not that I can think of.
It'd be a lot more work. Be a much bigger half.
How did Russo never think of that in TNA?
How about a 12-sided ring? Why even stop at six?
All three turnbuckles on each corner.
Oh, my God.
That's 18 turnbuckles.
18-sided ring?
14! 15! No! Start again. You could have a clock. Just goes right back to zero.
That would be the best match ever.
I'm stunned that didn't happen in TNA, to be honest.
The match itself, I felt, was kind of sacrificed as a backdrop for the whole ECW thing. I thought once that thing happened, it kind of took you right out of it. You know, this type of match allows for some stiff whipping that kind of drags you into it. But aside from that, I can't say I'm a big fan.
This was the WWF's first pay-per-view in Philadelphia since the King of the Ring 95, which featured King Mabel winning and defeating Savio Vega in the finals.
Okay.
An awful show that we have reviewed, which also features a Kiss My Foot match.
All right. Well, they can't all be winners.
No. And neither was Bradshaw here.
Did you – yeah, it's funny that we get to see Bradshaw in this show because did you watch his Legends interview with Hall and Nash?
Yes, I did.
I really enjoyed it. And in particular I guess it's interesting to think about Bradshaw from this period in 96 when he was, you know, just kind of floundering on the lower card. And it's fun to see him interact with Hall and Nash, who were at the time sort of like the big dogs in the company, right? And so there's like a point where they're kind of reminiscing about their memories of Bradshaw from back then. And like Nash brings up how like they hazed him by like stealing his cowboy rope and bell, and so Bradshaw couldn't find it. And you know, ultimately Bradshaw just kind of no-sold it, and so that they kind of earned their respect. But the idea that anybody would try to haze JBL, you know, is an interesting idea. So to look at him at this point in his career, maybe without as much power backstage or as much of a reputation backstage, is interesting to think.
Then we had a video for the Jim Cornette Jose Lothario feud, which featured all of Jim Cornette's old jokes on Jose. His social security number is 1. He wasn't offered history when he was in school because it didn't exist. And Jose's big comeback, this was a roast battle, told Jim Cornette, "You've got a big mouth."
Oh, ouch. You know, if like Jim Cornette was born in like the year 2000, if he was like a millennial, I think he'd make a great battle rapper.
I think he could be a hell of a battle rapper now.
Wow, yeah, maybe. I'd love to see that. Throw a beat underneath him.
I thought Jim Cornette was great here. Yeah. He comes out to Vader's music, which I found hilarious, just him coming out to Vader's music. But then when Jose came out,
yeah, not nearly as hilarious as Jose coming out to Shawn Michaels'
oh,
music.
Oh, God.
Which I believe he did at
WrestleMania. Shawn Michaels' logo on his jacket, too, the Heartbreak Kid.
Which I believe he did at WrestleMania 12, didn't he? Didn't he come out?
He came out, and then he points to the rafters for Shawn to come down.
So just the idea of this kind of 62-year-old man, balding, without 1/100th, 1/1000th of the charisma of Shawn Michaels, coming out to Sexy Boy and in tights this time.
If he had done the dance, game over.
He attempted to. If you watch closely as he tries to step into the ring, he steps in the ring and kind of does some punches in the air, like he's like fist pumping, but with
he might have seen a fly or something.
That's about as much a charisma as we've got out of him.
Before Jose makes his legendary entrance, we cut to the back, and the fake Razor and Diesel are stomping down Savio Vega, and then they flee out of the place. We don't see their faces, and Jim Ross does a big "I told you so," because he had teased they could be here tonight, and they are being advertised for Monday Night's Raw, which this thing was built up for so many weeks that Razor Ramon and Diesel will be on Raw. Not stating Kevin Nash or Scott Hall, but that's what you were led to believe. And this thing totally died and didn't do a rating the next night.
See, again, going back to that interview with JBL, that Legend show, Hall and Nash have a funny story about this, about how even execs at Turner weren't convinced that Hall and Nash weren't going to show up on Raw. So they ended up giving them a raise as a result of something like this, when I think every wrestling fan could tell.
Yeah. It's a hard story to digest because not only was this in the newsletters, there was, like, in Japan, it was reported because Rick Bogner, who would be the fake Razor, had to cancel a tour because it was known he was coming to the WWF for this gimmick. And first of all, like, 24 hours before, like, you got to see, okay, it's two fake guys. And this was not some secret that Rick Bogner and Glenn Jacobs were going to be used as fake guys. Like, you had these guys under contract. So it was, I don't know. With Hall and Nash, there's always, to me, a grain of salt you take with their stories. Those two, to me, are examples of don't let facts get in the way of a great story when you hear their interviews. But, I mean, if they did, more power to them. Jim Cornette cut a promo and says that Lothario is a legend and taught Shawn Michaels, but he is a broken-down cripple, and he won't hurt him if he just walks away. And Lothario comes out to Michaels' music in his tights and Michaels' logo on his jacket, and we get our big match with Cornette and Lothario, which thankfully was kept short. Cornette just bumped around for Lothario. He's begging him off, the exaggerated selling. He takes a right hand by Lothario and an uppercut, and Jose pins Cornette in 57 seconds. Not long enough to be offensive by any stretch, and they got into the big uppercut by Lothario. That's all this was.
Yeah, I guess the feud was all largely Jim Cornette's promos, making fun of the guy, and then delivering the payoff as quick and painlessly as possible.
Cornette is fun when he finally gets his comeuppance, and he just sells his ass off, which is what he did here. Mark Merrow and Sable and Farouk and Sonny are on the superstar line, because they will be meeting the next night on Raw for the vacant Intercontinental title. And you can see the shift way with Nitro now a year old, the emphasis on television. Like, they had that Razor Diesel angle set up for the night after. This match, I mean, traditionally, this would be on the pay-per-view for the vacant title. Instead, they saved that for Raw. And that night's Raw did a 2.0, and Nitro killed it with a 3.4. But you could see that emphasis now of shifting focus to the television.
Interesting. It's also interesting that they used to make you pay to listen in on these post-match, behind-the-scenes interviews. Call a hotline, kids, so that you can hear this exclusive conversation between Farouk and who else?
Mark Merrow.
Yeah. Whereas today, there's just so much free content now, so much that they put up on the network, on .com, that you couldn't pay me $1.99 a minute to sit through some of that stuff.
What if it was Tom Phillips and Titus O'Neil?
Call hotline for that? I'm not wasting the effort.
Would you get your parents' permission? Did you ever call the superstar line?
Never. I don't even know. I guess it was available in Canada,
though. It was in Canada, yes.
That's really expensive, you know? Like, I think phone sex costs about the same.
Well, these were comparable.
Yeah.
Farouk. Mark Merrow. Brian Pillman comes out next with his shirt with a gun and the words, "I don't call 911. And he had promised Bret Hart to be delivered here on this pay-per-view. Bret Hart was on his sabbatical. He had done some overseas tours, but nothing on TV since WrestleMania and the loss to Shawn Michaels. And they showed a clip of Bret Hart in South Africa responding, calling Pillman a liar, and never committed to appearing on this pay-per-view, and says Owen is also a liar. And we had, what a tie-in here. We had Pillman, who Owen later referred to as Pill, and this coming just days after Bret Hart, did a scathing interview calling the Fabulous Freebirds pillheads.
Oh, wow, okay. Interesting.
Just wording that ties in together. We cut back to Pillman in the ring. He calls this place in Philadelphia a sewer and a cesspool of drug abuse, battered women and welfare recipients and calls these people scum. And he brings out Owen Hart. And Owen comes out and Pillman says, Brett was always jealous of Owen's youth. And this is when Owen says, well, you know, Pill, he is the best Hart. And Brett is older and slower and not the technical wrestler he once was. This is in 1996 and feels Brett is getting senile, which is funny because he actually mispronounced this and went to call him Senil first before he had to correct himself and forgot his promise to appear here at Mind Games. And Owen says Brett is also scared of Steve Austin, to which Steve Austin comes out. Amazing all the people that were not booked on this show. No Sid, no Vader, no Austin, no Brett, but Brett was understandable. And he has been challenging Bret Hart, and Vince on commentary defends Brett, saying he never promised to appear at this event. And he says Stone Cold is, he mentions that when Stone Cold is in the house, Brett is at his house. And he is the slimy substance that runs out of the south side of a chicken. And this was where he used the line that was repeated in many video packages, that if you put the S in front of Hitman, you get his sentiments of Brett. And we'll whip his ass if they ever have a match. And Philadelphia sucks because I said so, is how Pillman ends this segment involving... This was quite the collection of guys. Austin, oh, yeah. Owen, and Pillman. You had the former tag partners. You would have the future issue between Austin and Owen at the next year's SummerSlam, and then Owen and Pillman, who had their links to Stampede Wrestling. And
all talking about Brett.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really four complete legends here involved in this segment, which is...
And big parts of the 97 angle.
Yeah, which is why I really enjoyed watching this alone, simply for nostalgic purposes. But you also had a set of great promos here. I thought Pillman did a great job talking shit about Philadelphia. And then... I also thought it was really cool to see Austin here in that brief time between. It seemed like at this point he had fully developed that Stone Cold Steve Austin character coming out of the King of the Ring. He had his lines, he had his swagger, but he also wasn't yet a babyface. So this was at a time when he was just a great, pure heel who was captivating and I thought drew legit heat. And I guess ultimately before being so entertaining that the crowd turned him for him. But the guy you could just see here just had a great presence. And some of those lines, like, you know, Brett doesn't qualify as a chicken. He's more like the slimy stuff that comes out from the bottom end of the chicken. Like, these lines aren't necessarily all that better than what's scripted for somebody like Roman Reigns on Raw. But Austin's delivery came across so natural and confident that it just sounded cool when he said it.
Yeah, and what a... What a transformation. I mean, just weeks after this, Austin would be storming Brian Pillman's home, and Pillman will be pulling a gun on him.
Oh, that happened after this?
This happened after.
Oh, okay.
Like the next month.
I thought the shirt, because wasn't he wearing the shirt?
He was.
About guns?
Yeah, I don't call 911.
Okay. I thought that was in reference to something. Yeah, okay. Interesting.
So they would have a... Well, this would have been weirder if they were getting so chummy along here after a home invasion.
That is true.
That concludes that segment. Very entertaining from all three of them. You really saw, Austin was about to explode as a character, and that would just take off that much more in 97 and obviously 98, a whole nother stratosphere. Then we had some highlights of Mark Henry, the debuting Mark Henry, taking in the sights of Philadelphia. The Liberty Bell, the George Washington statue, and other sites. And Vince once again just praising this new arena, calling it a magnificent edifice, the Cora State Center.
I suppose this was Vince's intent at creating, the next Patriot type of character, in the same vein as Hogan or the Lex Express. And for whatever reason, he chose Mark Henry to do it. Because the guy represented Team America, I suppose. And so they decided to show this by having Mark Henry be a tourist in Philadelphia. This to show how much he loves America.
What an odd thinking going into this show that, going into this, ECW was very hot in this city. What kind of reactions were guys like Pillman and Mick Foley going to get? And you really didn't get those reactions. But going into this, like... how do you feel you would be endearing a babyface to this crowd? It's like, well, let's show him being a man of the people, going to the sights and sounds.
Dressed up in
Philadelphia.
Dressed up in an American flag.
Oh, my gosh. And the leather hat and the jacket. God. Oh, yeah. Man. This was – what an interesting juxtaposition that you just saw Steve Austin in the last segment and how that guy was picking up steam and an eventual babyface for sure. Well, and then we went to the – old, tired presentation of a babyface with Mark Henry. Just one after the other. You just saw the change in climate.
Well, Austin really wasn't presented as a babyface. I mean, it took the crowd to tell Vince, hey, this is what we want. Whereas I feel like Vince was still very much stuck on, let's drape an American flag around this guy and people will like him.
96 was where everything started to very much get blurred, and it was the company trying to catch up with the audience, I think. And in 97, I thought they had a much better pulse of the audience and how to present these characters. Doc Hendricks, Michael Hayes, who we just mentioned, was in the first aid room, and Cornette is being tended to from the punch by Jose Lothario, and his lawyer, Clarence Mason, is there with a contract that Cornette blindly signs, which we would later learn was for the rights to manage the Bulldog and Owen. Always read what you sign.
Isn't this what dude did in Memphis, who am I thinking of? The Paul Neighbors? He did this.
Oh, right, where he was, he gave up where Burt Prentice was trying to sign off his guys for $10,000.
Yeah.
Paul Neighbors.
Always read what you sign.
The Smoking Guns, accompanied by Sonny, defended the tag titles next against Owen Hart and the British Bulldog.
So Owen walked to the back just to walk back out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, for the vote, 2 minutes in between. Bart is very annoyed here that Billy is preoccupied with Sonny on the way to the ring. And then Sonny, who at this time would always have this giant photo of her come down from the rafters, it had been doctored. And the Bulldog and Owen had drawn glasses on her with long hair and a goatee.
And a big ass.
I didn't even miss it. Yeah, I missed that.
They made her ass bigger.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that was. I was looking at this. I was like,
which was this, not. Yeah.
Is this the most offensive thing in the world? But Sonny sold this for all it was worth. She freaked out.
But it also kind of began to raise questions about which team was exactly the heel here, because doing something like that is very much a babyface move, isn't it?
What timing on some of the.
Oh, yeah.
Events going on at this time. Ross said that Sonny and Cornette had a more spirited debate on Livewire this past weekend than the upcoming Bill Clinton Bob Dole debates.
Yeah, the upcoming Clinton debates.
Man, unbelievable. Little did Jim Ross know what was in store 20 years later. Mm-hmm. I mean, putting Bill Clinton and Bob Dole to shame, be another Clinton debate. Clarence Mason comes down to ringside. He is the lawyer for Camp Cornette. Ross says that he should have been given the benefit of the doubt that Diesel and Razor was not a ratings ploy, and says, Vince, you were given the benefit of the doubt when you were indicted.
Ouch.
Stiff line with no response from Vince. Hmm. They worked over Bart Gunn. Owen chop blocks the left knee, very Usos-esque, and they work over the knee, keep him in their corner. I agree with you. I thought it got very complicated about who the audience was behind here, because it certainly wasn't Billy Gunn. It was almost like Bart was the only person you could have any kind of sympathy for, and not exactly a stunning baby face, especially in Philadelphia. There was a delayed vertical by Bulldog, and then he did that great forward roll kip up that he would throw out every now and then. Bart recovered, tagged in Billy. They did their version of poetry in motion with Bart coming off, Bart on his all fours, and Billy just wailing off the back of Bart into Bulldog in the corner. The sidewinder was hit by the Guns, and then Mason is distracting the referee as Owen comes off of the top and strikes Billy. He had just had the cast removed from his arm that he had had for months, and they continue the beatdown on the Bulldog. Bulldog shoves Bart into Billy, who is distracted talking to Sonny, and then Billy turns around and shoves Bart into a Bulldog running power slam, and they pin Bart Gunn in 11 minutes, and Owen and Davey Boy Smith win the tag titles.
Yeah, a little awkward due to the double heel nature of the match. You had Bart playing babyface in peril for the first half of the match, And then you had Bulldog doing the same in the second half. So it really just kind of came down to which team you hated the least. And it was a little weird to follow. Did you also notice, like, when the finish was, like, Billy shoving Bart, right?
Yes.
He essentially made himself the legal man.
You're right.
Via tag.
Yeah.
But it wasn't recognized, but I recognized it because
they should have had Clarence Mason on their side. Oh, he would have picked up on that.
There you go. So a little bit messy, but, you know, I'll say a real pleasure to see Owen and Davey Boy wrestle because I think, like, you know, watching as a kid, they're just kind of there. But watching as an adult, you have a greater appreciation of their technique. And both those guys are great.
Then Sunny cut it. She had a huge tantrum in the ring on the smoking guns. She says, "I gave everything to you," and fires them. And Billy chases after her. Bart is frustrated. And this would continue the dissension between the smoking guns. Kevin Kelly is in the bowels of the Core Estate Center, the magnificent edifice, with Mankind and Paul Bearer. And Bearer assures Mankind will win the title tonight. And Mankind cuts a promo saying that he has Misery and Destiny in store for tonight. He says he lives to make Michaels Click feel his pain. His destiny is to hear Michaels' liver rupture and cuddle that heavyweight title. I love these Mankind promos in 96. He was so into this character, and it was such a departure from Cactus Jack that you knew it was the same guy, but they were so different in presentation that it was a separation.
And it's such a departure from the Mick Foley we've seen for the better part of the past decade plus of him being this lovable Santa Claus type of a guy that it's almost hard to remember that he used to cut, you know, promos as this dark horror movie villain. So it'd be like imagine if Bray Wyatt in 20 years' time played fun, lovable general manager with his own reality show.
I like your comparison to Bray Wyatt because watching this Mankind character, and there's few people at the level of Mick Foley as a promo, as a character, that could create that character. But so much of Bray Wyatt has been, well, it's they're bound by PG. It's like,
no, nothing to do with that. Yeah, look at this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like I watched this. This was a totally PG character that was frightening at the time. That was he was put in these situations like in the bowels of an arena. His promos were so excellent, and you always knew what the message was, which I cannot say for half the time you hear a Bray Wyatt promo. And to me, this would be a much easier comparison, and I don't buy the, you know, you're not allowed to do blood, you're not allowed to be too violent or too creepy. It's like this company had a ton of success in PG settings in the 80s, in the 90s, and I don't think that handcuffs you at all when it comes to dark characters.
It would certainly help, you know. It would make things easier, but you're absolutely right. I don't think it's necessary.
Like, look at the corporate ministry or the Ministry of Darkness when they were at their raunchiest and some of the shit they did that was just – it was just stupid.
Yeah.
Like you were knifing Midian on camera and sacrificing people.
I know. That stuff's a bit too much. I guess the argument could always be that, you know, tastes have changed and would a Mick Foley promo like this be as effective in 2016?
I feel it would.
I think so too.
I mean there's obvious tweaks you'd make to the character.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at its core – it would still be really great. Jerry Lawler comes out, and they had done an angle on Superstars that day where he had walked up to Mark Henry and pretended to throw hot coffee on him, but it wasn't. And he slapped Mark Henry on the free-for-all during another debate segment. They love their debates here in 96. And Lawler is on the mic on his way to the ring with his music. He buries the Olympics. I thought he was very entertaining here.
Lawler essentially, like, this was his entrance music, was him coming out and cutting promos, talking shit about the Olympics. He hates the Olympics. That's the heat here.
This guy was so great.
Yeah. I really miss Jerry Lawler as this type of heel. I mean, he kind of played one, like, towards the end of his run on SmackDown, but he was not nearly as mean nor as quick as he was back then.
And he had multiple feuds going on at this point because it wasn't just Mark Henry, who I think it's a real sign that with this guy as limited as he was that we're going to pair him with Jerry Lawler.
Sure.
And at the same time, he had the feud going on with Jake that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way because of the just the alcoholism being the focal point of that feud. But that was going on at the same time as this Mark Henry program with Lawler. So
sort of a utility guy.
Yeah, he was – I mean – being used with multiple guys.
So what was Henry's contract at this time? What were kind of the circumstances surrounding his coming into the company?
So Mark Henry was a member of the U.S. Weightlifting team for both the 92 Olympics, where I think he finished like 10th, and then he was considered like this star going into 96. He was – they thought he was going – like this guy was legitimately one of the strongest men in the world going into 96. It wasn't just like a catchphrase. But he suffered an injury during the Olympics, and he ended up not even being able to finish. I think he ended up like 14th, right. And he had been going on – he was on Oprah. He was on talk shows at the time. He was a major Olympic figure that year.
And had a guest appearance on Raw before the actual Olympics.
Yes, and the WWF was sponsoring him. He signed his deal, which was a 10-year deal at the time. So yeah. As you can imagine, he probably had – a lot of heat at the time for coming in with such a great contract.
With zero wrestling experience.
None. None. He was in the elementary stages of his career.
10 years. Like, has there ever been a contract that they've signed for anybody for that long?
Paul White, I think, had 10.
10.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
at least that guy, you know.
I mean, this was
had some
you know, Vince loved his giants and viewed Mark Henry as – I mean, earlier in 96 – I mean, the thought of this guy going to the Olympics, winning gold, and all of the attention, and little did they know it would be another Olympian that did win gold in 96. That would be a much bigger deal for them in the short term. So Mark Henry ended up kind of – I mean, the Olympics were kind of a bust for him. Was still marketed here as the world's strongest man.
He got me for 10 years.
Vince wasn't going to let – that. Maybe he was behind the Lawler promo. I mean, fuck the Olympics. I'm promoting this guy as the winner. So Henry comes out in his USA outfit, and Jim Ross says that according to his – in terms of Mark Henry's technique, he is not ready yet. And Lawler says maybe at the next – maybe at the next Olympic Games, Mark Henry can go as a javelin catcher.
That's funny. I like how Jim Ross always, you know, tries to protect his credibility.
Always.
You're not going to see anything that great.
In a weird way, this reminded me of like – this was like the pro wrestling equivalent of CM Punk's UFC debut, how Ross kind of approached it.
Sure.
It's like this guy is coming in. He's not ready.
This is
but the idea was he was going to bring us a lot of attention. And Lawler's going to prove that Mark Henry can't even escape a basic headlock. And we did have USA chance at the start of this match. And a headlock is applied by Lawler, and Mark Henry counters out of it into a hammerlock and then shoves Lawler into the corner as the crowd was chanting Burger King at Lawler.
Yeah.
Was it going to be a happy meal for Jerry Lawler? We would find out. Then Henry applies a headlock, and Lawler does a hammerlock counter. And Vince suggests that someone has – or sorry, it was Henry again with a hammerlock. And Vince suggests that someone has been training Mark Henry. There was a press slam by Henry, and then we zoomed in on Henry's calves by the cameraman. Look at those tree trunks. And Henry
– his calves I feel like are the least impressive portion of him.
He's – I mean it's like rather smaller proportioned.
Yeah, his thighs, you know, massive.
Yeah, I guess we'd be getting out of PG territory if we were zooming in on the
right.
Thighs. Henry sidestepped and Lawler flew through the ropes, and I mean flew. This was one of the more vicious bumps I've seen Jerry Lawler take in decades.
I agree. The guy basically flew headfirst from the ring into the guardrail. So he
– like his head crashed into the guardrail.
He essentially pulled off a tope suicida.
Yes.
Without trying to.
Emphasis on the suicida.
Yeah.
And – so he gets back in, and Lawler has a foreign object in his trunks. I mean, this was so – this match was brought to you by Memphis. Like every trick in the book
here.
From
the 1970s, yes.
Yeah. He pulls it out of his trunks, and he clocks Henry. Then he hides the object.
I was hoping for a fireball myself.
Oh, man. This place would have gone nuts. Mm. And Henry, out of nowhere, tie clinch with knees.
Was it a tie clinch?
This was as close to a tie clinch as I've ever seen Mark Henry use.
Sure.
And then into the Sammartino-style backbreaker, which Lawler submits at 5:13, not identified as a Sammartino-style backbreaker, but that seemed to be the template here was Bruno Sammartino, Mark Henry. And
in 1996, okay, I guess.
Like they clearly had grand plans for Mark Henry, which, I mean, it would take a long time. Mark Henry certainly never reached the level they probably anticipated.
No.
And I wouldn't even say this guy really hit a stride till 2011, when he won the title from Orton, and then 2 years later did the Salmon Jacket promo. But, I mean, Christ, the guy not only lasted those 10 years, he's been there 20, which is maybe the story of Mark Henry's career.
Yeah.
So he stayed there.
Yeah, yeah. Seeing him in his very first match, though, you can look at this like it was almost a masterclass from Jerry Lawler on how to carry a complete novice working with somebody, Mark Henry, who I assumed only had several weeks, if not, you know, not very much pro wrestling training. So Henry exactly had 5 moves in this entire match, and that was the hammerlock. That was the headlock, chop to the head, a military press, which actually looked decent, and then that
backbreaker,
Canadian backbreaker rack, that just looked terrible, I thought. But it took Lawler's physical acting, his squirming, and his great facial expressions to create a somewhat compelling story here. So really all the credit to Jerry Lawler. And on WWE.com for the 20th anniversary, they actually released a video, an interview with Jerry Lawler and Mark Henry talking about this match, reminiscing about this debut match. And Henry talked about how he was really nervous before he was going out there with Jerry Lawler because he was aware of Lawler's legacy. And he basically thanked Lawler for letting him and The Rock work in Memphis after this match to help him gain experience. So, like, I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of cool. This is, like, a cool little feature. I like hearing these, you know, director's commentary types of things with guys involved in matches from the past. And so I was expecting Lawler to come back with, like, you know, much more analysis. But Lawler just kind of breaks into this, like, recap of the match in kayfabe terms.
Can you believe 20 years since that match?
You're right. It's September of 1996, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And I remember standing at the curtain feeling like my heart was going to explode out of my chest. And
you were scared of me, weren't you? You were scared.
Scared of what I was going to do to you.
Oh, my gosh.
No, I was more afraid of not living up because I've been a fan my whole life. And I knew exactly who you were. And to be able to just to stand across from the legacy that you created for yourself was kind of pressing on me.
Oh,
it was
man.
Like, it was
please.
It was hard. And I appreciate you having me and The Rock come to Memphis and work in your territory after that to get experience and to actually know what wrestling was all about.
Well,
and
I
appreciate
that. Listen, I remember that. I remember that match vividly, and I was scared because of your reputation. And you know, I had you started in 1996. I started in 1971, so you're still just a baby compared to me.
The year that I was born.
Yeah, so I've wrestled a lot of strong guys. Ken Patera, who was billed as the world's strongest man at one time, wrestled that guy a bunch of times. And but then, you know, your reputation preceded you. It was something different. And I'll never forget, at that time, Vince McMahon was doing the commentary.
Right.
And we got in the ring, and the match started. And, you know, a typical thing, I was going to just see how really strong you were. So I remember I hit the ropes. Next thing you know, I'm down on my back. And I said, well, that didn't work, but you know what? I'm dumb enough to try it again. So I said, I'll hit him harder this time. I hit the ropes again, and bam, the big collision, bam, flat on my back again. So, you know, I figured, hey, third time's a charm. Do it one more time, King.
Too smart for that.
Right, you were.
Sidestep.
I hit the ropes. This guy sidesteps me, and just a swat on my back like that, to you, it was a swat. It was like I'd been hit by a freight train from behind. out through the ropes. I couldn't even grab the ropes in time. I sailed out through the ropes all the way across the... Hit the barricade with my face, look.
And like this. And I'll never forget. I came up, I opened my eyes, and I'm looking up at Vince McMahon. And I just went...
And Vince went... And I came back later and said, he is the world's strongest man. I'll never forget that match, man. And you've done sensational since then. I'm really proud of you.
Talking about how, I was so dumb to try to run into you time and time again as you stonewalled me. And I really wanted to see how strong you were, so I engaged you in a test of strength. So I was a little disappointed by Lawler's portion of that interview. But I'd love for them to...
Do you think Lawler remembers this match?
He claims he remembered it vividly, but I don't know. Maybe he watched it right before.
I mean, Lawler's done some incredible stuff, but his recall is not at the highest.
I have no clue. He claims he remembered the match vividly, but whatever. I'd love for them to do more of these types of things on .com, though. Guys just kind of talking about their classic matches.
Just for selfish purposes. I mean, I'm sure I'll use clip in the show. So I will say this about Mark Henry. Like, watching this, most people, I mean, seeing this guy for the first time, at having watched this match, I would probably have said, I'd like to see where this guy is in 3 or 4 years. And if you had shown me a match from 99-2000, I'd be like, that's it. Like, there was enough here that I was like, okay, like...
Was there enough here, though, man? I didn't even see much.
I mean, he's
this.
An athlete, right?
He's okay, strong.
There's something to build upon here.
I wouldn't
here.
Say he's like... He's certainly an athletic, absolutely. He's an Olympic athlete. But is this the type of guy, right type of guy you'd want for a professional wrestler, though, even in 96?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly a changing industry for them. But
and, like, you look at Mark Henry even to this day, what's his biggest strength? No pun intended. It's not necessarily his strength. It's his promo, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think that's his strongest point, and he didn't really get to develop that until later, much later on.
Then Leaf Cassidy ran down Al Snow, and he jumped Mark Henry from behind and got dumped to the floor. Then Marty Jannetty ran in, and this was weird because, like, Henry was, like, looking to the floor, and Jannetty had to run from the floor into the ring, and Henry had to pretend like he didn't see this guy just run right past him and behind. And he got tossed away. And then Hunter Hearst Helmsley came in next, and Hunter got press slammed to both of the rockers on the floor for the pop. Vince proclaims he's the strongest man in the world, and the understatement, we'll be seeing a great deal more of Mark Henry, and got a pyro display afterwards.
Yeah, I know. They were going all out. Triple H, not booked. Instead,
yeah. Being fed. Well, this was during his period where he was just... This was post curtain call and just getting shit upon.
Being fed butt to Mark Henry.
Yeah.
Which was left out of that anniversary recap.
Yeah, that didn't make it. We didn't get Hunter's comments about his interaction.
No.
And the idea here is that the locker room is jealous of Mark Henry, and that's why they were trying to make a name off of Henry here.
Like, off of the contract? They made mention of the contract?
Well, they said that they're trying to make a name off this big star who's come in with all this attention.
Do you know how much money that he was rumored to be receiving?
I think it was like six figures.
Yeah, per year.
Per year.
Yeah.
So
okay. Interesting.
They promoted the next In Your House, which was a month away, which would be the Buried Alive match between The Undertaker and Mankind. And this is not sanctioned. And Jim Ross is clearly not crazy about this idea. And this was weird. They said regardless, because it's unsanctioned, this would not be a title match. Which, to say before the main event, to me it's when you're promoting this – why not leave that option open that this could end up being a WWF title match for next month?
Because
Mankind is challenging tonight for the title, and they're already promoting the next pay-per-view that Mankind is headlining.
Right, and they're saying it won't be a title match.
They're saying flat out it won't be a title match because it's unsanctioned. To me, it's just... Yeah. Well,
but if it's unsanctioned...
Well... I guess then their hands were bound.
If it was today, they would probably leave that fact out until the end of the match.
And then we got a video for the final curtain match and the feud involving Goldust and The Undertaker. And no DQ and no countout is the definition of a final curtain match.
Final curtain match, gotcha.
Undertaker has no pallbearer and no urn anymore. He's relying on his own power.
Hmm.
And Taker immediately attacks him, Goldust snaps him on the top rope, and he's slapped by Marlena, who's in the corner of Goldust. And the amount of times we got the descriptions of Goldust as mind games and histrionics, that's how we described Goldust's antics in 1996.
Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't do an in-your-house histrionics.
Histrionics, yeah, with another animation.
Yeah.
Yes, with like maybe a book that opened up like an encyclopedia.
Wow.
Histrionics. Goldust goes after the Undertaker's eye after throwing gold confetti into the eye.
Glitter. Yeah.
This was the least believable thing the Undertaker's ever had to sell. My eyes!
No, that's not true, man.
Glitter.
Have you ever had glitter in your eyes?
I don't think it'd be this bad.
It'd be distracting. It'd be annoying as shit, okay? I'll tell you that. I have never had glitter in my eyes either, but I'm sure many women maybe doing makeup. I don't know.
We should have done this as a test.
Glitter in the eyes?
Yeah.
I buy it, man.
So then we had him just go to town on the eyes, even driving the eye into the steps. Now, that might have caused a problem. And the Undertaker gets run into the announce desk. It's all Goldust here, and the crowd is chanting, "Rest in peace." Taker finally reverses him in the corner and attacks with body shots. Goldust had a power slam for a two count, and then Taker sits up, hits a flying clothesline, and Goldust takes a choke slam off the second turnbuckle. And there was a guy facing the hard camera running across the aisle with a sign that read Goldust with smaller text below, and I didn't even try to read it. Knowing this is 1996 with this character, I knew I would have been offended if I could make this out.
Possibly.
And he calls for the tombstone, and he hits the tombstone, and he wins in 10-22.
Mm-hmm.
And we plug the Buried Alive match. Pretty much one finish to do with this guy headlining the next show. And this was the end of the feud after three pay-per-view matches between The Undertaker and Goldust.
Three matches they did?
They did.
Oh, God.
They did, was it three? This might have been the second. Okay. I might have been off
even
by
that,
one.
Even that's a little too much. I mean, I'll say, these are the two of the best and certainly most enduring original gimmicks that the WWF has ever created. You know, well, I'm not talking about guys like The Rock or Shawn or Bret who are...
No, strict characters.
You know, just extensions of themselves. But yeah, this like extravagant cartoony stuff. Hard to think of better examples than The Undertaker and Goldust, who are two characters that are still around to this day. And I think much of that has to do with the performers playing the two characters and how great they are at performing these, at performing the role. But this match was a boring match, man. It was Taker doing his slow zombie thing.
Selling a lot.
In this instance, it was just not fun to watch at all, and neither was Goldust. You know, he had a very slow, brawling style, not much varied offense, just a slow heavyweight match.
That's a good description of it. Afterwards, Kevin Kelly is with Shawn Michaels backstage, and he says he hasn't been nervous defending his title up until now. He knows he can go out and out-wrestle anyone, but this guy is nuts, in reference to Mankind. He says if there was a mind up here, there would be something to play with, but he doesn't have much up here. Which I'm sure many of his coworkers agreed with at this time period in 1996. And that was Shawn. And the announcer's way, my God, they were very spooked by these words because they have never heard Shawn Michaels so nervous before a match than this one.
Did he sound nervous to you?
Not really. He didn't convey nervous to me.
He didn't really convey even all that much. And what
he conveyed a lot of disinterest in talking to Kevin Kelly.
Yeah, I kind of gathered from this more the idea that I feel Shawn is much more entertaining as a heel. At least this version of Shawn in 1996 was much more, to me, much more entertaining as a heel than he was as a babyface.
I think it's harder to go back and watch Shawn Michaels as a babyface in 96 when he was pushed as the ultimate babyface, knowing how much of an asshole he was in 1996.
Just the way he came across, too. He just seemed, he was the cocky guy, right?
And you knew that was him.
Yeah. And I don't know, it just didn't really feel all that likable. Whereas as a heel, he was great.
The Druids bring a casket down ringside. Paul Bearer follows, and then Mankind emerges from the casket for the main event. And Paul Bearer and Jose Lothario are in the corners as Shawn Michaels makes his entrance. And Vince McMahon, like, forget mind games. This was mind lost by Vince McMahon for Shawn Michaels' entrance. He was so excited for Shawn Michaels' entrance here.
No lack of confidence in the press. It's as if the Philadelphia Flyers have won the Stanley Cup on the 76ers, the NBA championship. Listen to this if you want.
My God. Do you know how old these two were? They were both the same age, Sean and Mick, in 96. Guess how old they were.
96? Well, I'm going to say 33.
31 years old.
Wow.
At this time.
That's it?
They were younger than us.
That's
you were older than Mick Foley in 96.
Wow.
Headlining Mind Games.
It's incredible.
Mankind lifts the padding on the floor, and Michaels drop kicks it, stomps Mankind underneath the padding on the floor. And then we got a reverse cross off the turnbuckle to Mankind to the floor and followed that up with a top rope elbow in the ring. They were setting a furious pace immediately. And he sets up for sweet chin music early, and Mankind launches himself to the floor to avoid the kick.
It's hard for me to think of a faster Mick Foley match than this one.
Yeah, he talks about this match in his first book about how he got on this cardio workout to prepare for this.
He looked in tremendous shape.
He did. And held up with Shawn Michaels for
25 minutes. Yeah.
This was one match I actually forgot the time, so that's important for this one.
Yeah.
So Mankind then comes back and goes for the mandible claw, which was such a protected finish in 96. He had just been running through everybody with this, had defeated The Undertaker. I mean, this was Mankind being positioned as the top challenger at this time. Michaels reverses on top and starts fighting Mankind in his guard.
There's some early MMA here.
A lot of great guard work here.
Mankind had the body lock with Sean's back.
That's right. He took his back.
He went for a rear naked mandible claw.
Why don't more fighters do this when they have the back, the mandible claw?
Well, you're not allowed to fish hook.
That's true, MMA. And that's the definition of...
Technically, this would be a fish hook.
Yeah. Mankind pulls out the Spanish desk.
But in Japan...
All bets are off.
Yeah.
Mankind pulls out the Spanish desk... And then Michaels dives over the desk on the floor into Foley and then vertical suplexes Mankind, dropping him knee first onto the steel steps. This sadly became a staple for Mick Foley. And knowing all the knee problems he had, and I mean, we've seen him at conventions and stuff where he's getting around. I mean, these are hard to watch.
Wait, but is this spot necessarily that damaging, though? Because to me, it seemed more like your impact is taken on your back. Obviously, there's some, you know, impact on your foot. But I always thought that it was more so the sound that, you know, the steps made with the foot that kind of created the illusion that it was much more hurtful for the foot than it was.
I mean, I was watching this, and it was like, the knee was landing first on the steps. And it's like, in other ones, too. Hmm. It seemed like this... The damage was to the knees here and not just crashing into the steps.
Should have asked Mick Foley last week.
I know. Damn. What a lost opportunity here. So anyway, Michaels then works over the knee, does a lot of good stuff here. Dragon screw leg whip, applies a figure four. Mr. Perfect calls this a perfect game plan because he's stealing his moves. And it's all offense on the knee.
Shawn does a great job working on the leg, throwing in a ton of offense that I haven't usually seen Shawn Michaels do.
They mixed in, like, good storytelling here, body work, and then brawling throughout this. I mean, this match had everything. And then Mankind dropped him throat first on the top rope and took an object from Paul Bearer, like this... What would you call it that he started stabbing his own knee with to, like, wake it up?
Like an EpiPen or something.
That was his issue, an EpiPen. It was like he was just stabbing himself with this blunt object and then hit a running knee to Michaels, who was seated in the corner. Irish whipped Michaels into a tree of woe and followed that with a running elbow. And then Michaels goes to the floor. Mankind runs at him, misses, and goes knees first into the step. That was not good either. And then there was a drop toe hold by Michaels onto the steps.
In hindsight, yeah, it's no good, but they're all great spots. You know, Mick Foley, Mankind made great use of the steel steps.
There was a vertical suplex, and Michaels ended up on the edge of the apron with Mankind, and then Mankind missed Michaels and ran into the post from the apron. Then Mankind gets thrown to the ropes, and this was a specialty of his. I know Samu of the Head Shrinkers would do this, and Foley did too, and this was how he lost his ear, was getting himself tied up into the ropes by his neck. And I don't care how many times I watched this, it was insane to watch.
It's so awesome. It really is so great. And I don't know if there is simply not enough people that could pull it off today, or if it's maybe a little bit dangerous. I don't know, but I'm surprised more people don't use it. Maybe because it's so closely associated with Mick Foley. But this thing looks so freaky.
Yeah, the fact you don't see this tells me that just people are – because it looks super cool.
Yeah.
But enough that – especially, I mean, the difference was in WCW you had those cables.
Sure.
As opposed to actual rope that the WWF used.
You figure the rope would be easier.
Well, the rope was easier. I mean, the cables, I mean, you tie that up and it's on your ear. Yeah. I mean, you saw what the result was.
But also, I mean, you're taking a lot of impact probably, again, on the lower body, on the knees, right, when you're doing that big whip. And so I guess Mick Foley was
crazy. I don't think Lance is teaching this.
You don't think so?
Probably not. I don't know if anyone's teaching this. So then he got the mandible claw on briefly after recovering from this, reapplied it on the floor, and Michaels throws him into the barricade. And the highlight of this was Hugo Savinovich falling out of his seat.
I missed that.
Michaels then uses chair shots, hits the knee with it, and then starts attacking the hand, which made all the sense in the world to take away the mandible claw from him unless he had another EpiPen.
Right. Though he bit the hand. And, I mean, it's always been debated. Why don't people just bite down on the Socko or the mandible claw to counter it? And the idea is that you're nervous being pinched so you can't move. So I guess if you are the one to initiate putting the fingers in your mouth, you'd be able to avoid the nerves, I guess. I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, maybe it's jaw manipulation as well. I mean, if you could cause the jaw to come out of alignment, you're not biting shit.
But the nerve that it's supposed to target, it's supposed to be under your tongue.
I should have come to Hamilton.
But
Mick Foley interview.
That's what I've always heard.
The biological breakdown of the mandible claw.
Yeah, that's what I've always heard. Is like it's the two fingers reaching into some nerve underneath your tongue, and I specifically remember being a child and trying to do it to myself. And it didn't work.
If your parents caught you, they'd really be concerned about you. I swear, it's just wrestling.
Doing
research right now.
In my mouth.
Oh, man. You could have become a supermodel. Then Michaels is trying to break the fingers. He leaps and stomps on them. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't care how much of a baby face Michaels was and Mankind was this deranged character. Well, this dick move. Like, stomping on these fingers.
It's like stomping on the toes in MMA.
Marco Huas. Yeah, it's bullshit. He runs at Mankind and takes a back body drop to the floor, just going all over the place here for Foley. And then Mankind hit his elbow off the apron to the floor. Mankind's going for repeated covers. He tosses chairs into the ring, rolls Michaels into the casket, but he fights off Mankind, hits the flying forearm and kip up, and the crowd's going nuts for Michaels here in his comeback.
Was this even a no DQ match?
No, it wasn't, and Jim Ross brought up that the referee is being very liberal here.
Yeah.
And was obviously a DQ because that's how it would end. And Michaels got crotched and then suplexed on the turnbuckle, and as he gets crotched, Michaels reverses a back suplex by Foley, and both go through the table on the floor with Michaels landing on top. And this is a real sign of just they did not break tables a whole lot here. There was the Brett Diesel match from the year prior. This was such a novel spot, and this crowd went nuts for this one table break. And it was really spectacular.
It's amazing to me to think that I guess the idea of hardcore was so protected and calm in September of 1996, yet less than 2 years later, we get, of course, Mick Foley's dive off the cell.
Yeah, look at where they would escalate to.
Yeah.
And they get back up. There's a chair on the canvas in the ring. Foley is on the turnbuckle, and Michaels would leap off the chair and hit a Sweet Chin Music into Mankind, who's holding another chair on the turnbuckle. He goes for the cover, and Vader runs in, causing the DQ finish.
Yeah.
A sad finish to what was an unbelievable match.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little unfortunate. I think
I love this match so much that I didn't even hold the finish against it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't think anybody really, you know, does. Although it does kind of prevent it from being that perfect match, you know what I mean? Which they were very close to achieving,
This was a 4¾-star star match from Dave Meltzer.
Definitely. Oh, wow. Okay, there you go. Simply for that finish. I mean, you know, it made sense because I guess you had the title to keep on Shawn, yet you had Foley to headline your next show. You know, well, whatever. It's fine. If you can watch this match, though, ignoring that, this was just a real pleasure to watch. I love the idea that Mick Foley, the guy known for jumping off the Hell in a Cell for the Japanese death matches, I love the idea that he would choose this as his favorite match up until that Orton match, because this is not hardcore at all. The biggest spot was that table spot, which by today's standards is, you know, very tame. So, I mean, everything else here was just traditional storytelling and good technical wrestling at a great pace executed to perfection. So I think I could understand why Mick Foley would choose this as his favorite performance.
Michaels fights off Vader. They were coming off the SummerSlam match the month prior. And Paul Bearer then attacks Michaels from behind with the urn, prompting Sid to run down. And this crowd, they went nuts for Sid. And he fights Vader to the back. They would also have a match at the next pay-per-view, with the winner getting a title shot, and that would be Sid. And Ross is just putting over both Michaels and Foley for the match they just had, and that they are the story. Almost giving like this nod to the audience that we know this finish sucked, but let's not get away from the fact we saw an unbelievable match.
Absolutely.
And the mandible claw is applied to Michaels. And then, I fucking love this, Paul Bearer opens the casket and the Undertaker is there and pops up. This crowd lost their minds for the Undertaker being in that casket. And he attacks Mankind to the floor. Vince couldn't help himself. You talk about mind games. And Michaels is announced the winner by DQ, and it ends with him posing in the ring and showing off his ass tattoo, pulling down his trunks so that they could all see his tattoo. It's amazing this man was not booed out of the building.
What anybody would do,
but
at the end of a grueling
hell of a match.
Yeah.
And a great return by the Undertaker. I really like that spot at the end. I mean, it goes off the air with the focus on the next month's main event. Mm-hmm. Totally made sense. And, yeah, this was a phenomenal main event.
Yeah, certainly very well done, very well remembered. And I think it's required viewing for any WWE wrestling fan. I'd say any North American wrestling fan.
Yes.
Any wrestling fan in the world, in the history. Required viewing for any human being.
Everybody. No matter where you are, where you live in the world, you should go watch this.
Yep.
Whether you find it online or a VHS somewhere.
And if you're going to watch this match, watch the whole show. Do what we did, okay? If we're going to have to sit through this whole thing, if I had to sit through Jose Lothario, Jim Cornette, you do it too.
Okay, if this match was a 10 out of 10, what was this card without the main event? A 2?
If you're being generous, yes.
Like, there's nothing on this show, to be honest.
Nothing. What was the second best thing out of this? I mean,
the match?
I mean, that the Austin promo was a good one.
Oh, I was talking matches. Yeah, the promo segment was the second best thing on this show.
I thought the Taker Gold Dust match was pretty awful. What else we had here? Lawler. Henry.
Lawler. It was a one-man performance. No, I mean, I enjoyed Lawler. Good.
The Smoking Guns and Bulldog and Owen. Sorry, nothing there. And then the ECW invasion in the middle of that the rope match. No. Jose Lothario, Jim Cornette. No.
It's like WWF with the contrasting quality level was playing mind games with the audience that night.
But it's okay. It's still a show that everybody fondly remembers because of the main event.
And it was a long main event by WWF standards. Yeah. 25 minutes was a lengthy period of time in 1996. Mm-hmm. And I'll give this show overall, I give it a 7.5 out of 10. And without the main event, probably less than a 2.
Yeah, yeah. I'd probably go with, like, I was going to rate it about 7-something, but then now you just reminded me of all the shit that I just had to sit through to get to that main part. So I'm going to have to go a little lower. I'm going to say maybe 6.7.
You have to remember as well, I mean, from start to finish, I mean, the match was 25 minutes. You had the post-match, the entrances and everything. I mean, that was probably all told about 35, 40 minutes of time, and this was only a 2-hour pay-per-view.
Yeah.
So the best part of the show was also a significant portion of the show, too. This wasn't a 3-hour pay-per-view.
That is true.
So there you have it. That was our review of Mind Games. We'll head to the Law message board at lawradio.proboards.com. We start off with Mick Whalen. Mind Games was not a great show, as the undercard was either really bad or boring. It needed a great match to save it, as the pay-per-view was getting perilously close to being an all-time bad show. Thankfully, the main event was a great one and easily one of the best matches of 1996 and the 90s in general, and arguably the best non-gimmick in-your-house match ever. Michaels had to get down and dirty to fight Mankind, and he also did a good job selling his nervousness when it came to Mankind. The sweet chin music into the chair was always a cool spot that I enjoyed. The only knock against it was the DQ finish and Vader missing his cue to interfere. It's not often that a great match can save a show, but this main event did. At worst, this show is watchable, or at best, it was passable again, only thanks to the main event. Mind Games is a textbook one-match show and gets a 5.5 out of 10. Question for John and Way, looking back at the main event, would you say the Shawn Mankind match was the best WWE match of 96, or were matches like the Iron Man match or Bret Austin better in your opinion? Would you rank those three, Way?
He's talking about the SummerSlam Bret Austin match?
The Survivor Series.
The Survivor Series? I feel like I hadn't seen that one in a while, so I can't really
You know
really
what?
Say.
We reviewed that show, and it was me and Arda that did it.
Oh, okay.
When you were not here.
So, yeah, it's been a long, long time since
I put this number one, to be honest. I know everyone loves that Iron Man match with Bret and Shawn, but of the three matches you just listed, I put this one, I put Bret Austin 2, and I put the Iron Man 3.
Iron Man matches, I'd say, aren't necessarily fun watches to go back and sit through. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how many people want to go through and invest an hour into a match they already know the outcome of. But I'd say that's more impressive of a feat simply for the physical feat. And, of course, it's significantly more significant.
All right.
So I would go with the Iron Man match.
You would go with the Iron Man match over this?
Yeah.
Okay.
We go to Joe in Maryland, who says, "Hi, John and Way. I can't believe this pay-per-view is over 20 years old. This late 96 era was when everything started to change for WWF. I believe the Pillman-Austin home invasion episode of Raw was only a few weeks after this. The roster was spread thinly, but I think it worked in their favor. Sandman's rat tail was phenomenal. Sonny was so good. Look, promo, and everything else. So much better than Sable would ever become, but certainly not as much of a star. Mark Henry was very green here. So was Bradshaw, but not nearly as much. Both would survive low mid-card statuses in the Attitude Era and win world titles years later. Awesome main event. Any show with an Owen match on a separate segment with him on the mic is going to be a little better than it would have been without him."
Christian writes, "While I agree with most of the general fans that the WWF title match was an all-time classic for the company, I'm still bugged by the finish. Kind of sours me. It sours the match for me a bit. After all that time, and to have such a flat DQ baffles me. Also, looking back, WWE weren't very good at pushing their champion in the mid-90s. During this time, Shawn did a draw with the Bulldog, beat him in an overbooked rematch, actually lost twice before beating Vader, and then couldn't actually pin Mankind here. Back to this show, that match was the only real saving grace, and nothing else was really worth watching on this show."
Aram from Denmark. Yeah, we haven't heard from Aram in a while.
He is back.
He says, "Hi, John and Way, long time no feedback. I love the themed In Your Houses back in 96. One thing I always wondered was why they kept booking Undertaker Goldust for the in-between feuds while Taker had an ongoing feud with Mankind. That's something you would never see anymore, wrestlers having more than one feud going on at once. Besides that, whatever happened to Clarence Mason?"
He just kind of left afterwards. He went to WCW for a bit. He was there as Jay Biggs. And I mean, the guy was a legit lawyer. And they just hired him for this. He was pretty much a spoof on Johnny Cochran. And stuck around in the WWF for a little bit after this, like throughout 97. And then, yeah, would resurface in WCW. And that was about it. I have no idea what he's up to now. So next one is from Sean from England. Mind Games was the perfect example of a one-match show, which a lot of these early In Your Houses were. The strap match between Bradshaw and Vega was only memorable from the invasion from that small local company, and that was restricted to a very small part of the match. I feel it wouldn't have really mattered who won. Jose Lothario versus Jim Cornette should have been saved for an episode of Raw, but Jose looked in great shape for a guy his age. Even though it featured a title change, which John seems to think never happened at the early In Your Houses, despite the first title change happening at the second edition. The tag match was pretty average, and it seemed like it was just a showcase for Sonny to dump the guns. Mark Henry had no right being in the ring, let alone on pay-per-view. At this stage of his career, he simply wasn't ready for... And that showed in his match with Lawler. Goldust and Undertaker never seemed to have any great chemistry in the ring, although at the time, both guys were all about their characters rather than their in-ring work. In fact, I feel this era is probably Dustin Reynolds' weakest part of his in-ring career. The main event is simply amazing and probably WWE's match of the year in 96. Both guys were awesome, and we didn't get the sulky Shawn we had in a lot of matches around this time, his match with Vader at SummerSlam being a perfect example. The only weakness of this match was the finish. I know Foley had another main event against Taker a month later, but I don't think it would have hurt the Mankind character to take a pinfall loss here. Overall, the main event lifts this to a 6.5 table bumps out of 10.
Terry from Mid Wales, UK. I'll echo everyone's thoughts of everyone above, and it's possibly you, John Away, of describing Mind Games as a one-match show, but what a match. I've never watched Michaels Mankind before, so thanks for giving me the excuse to. All the savage bumping both men seem to be keen to do for one another to some of the more fun spots, like Shawn jumping up and down on a poor mat-covered Mick Foley, all makes for an unorthodox but fresh, still to this day, WWF World Title main event with two legendary performers. The finish didn't bother me too much as the way the show was already hinting at the next... one already and buried alive, making it somewhat clear that this wasn't going to end clean. Question, do you think Shawn Michaels in 96 is the best in-ring yearly performance any one wrestler has ever had? I'm struggling to think of anyone who can top his amount of great and above level of quality in the squared circle that year, or any other year for that matter.
Sorry, what was the question?
He's asking if Shawn's 96 is the best year any wrestler's had in-ring.
Oh, I wouldn't say the best ever. I mean, go back to some of the Kobashi years. I mean... there's plenty, I would say, of Japan. I mean, Michael's 96 was fantastic. I would say probably his best in-ring year, though I'm sure you could come up with some arguments for...
I think it also depends on, like, the context of the era, too.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, I mean, if you're talking about guys of today, people are having great matches today, you know, all the time. Like, somebody like an AJ is having tremendous matches every single month. But I don't know. Do you grade that on a curve? You know.
Yeah, I mean that's such a loaded topic of where you could go amongst many different guys and best in ring year ever. It's going to be subjective too, based on your tastes and
what would you say is Shawn's best in ring year?
Yeah, I'm just thinking right now that 96 is up there. I mean 97 was pretty fantastic as well. I mean. All of his years in the 90s. I mean, 96, he was doing more main events, but I mean, 94, 95. 95 in particular stands out for me.
Any of his second portion of his career that stand out?
I would say, I mean, 02 had the big comeback match, but in terms of consistency, he had probably more. 04, he was doing a lot more TV matches, and he had, those two triple threats with Hunter and Benoit were back-to-back months, and that was on top of... the feuds he was doing with Hunter. 2004 was a really good year.
He's a pretty good wrestler as well.
Yeah, he did okay.
Yeah.
Enough that you could probably come up with multiple years and debate which was his best year.
Hmm.
I might lean 97, to be honest. I mean, he had quite a variety of opponents that year, but it was also out for a portion. All right, that is going to wrap it up for us. We are done. That was In Your House Mind Games from September of 96. The next review away will be coming out on Friday, October the 28th, and we will be joined by a mystery reviewer. And the subject...
Mystery? You're not even going to reveal what you're talking about?
Well, I said mystery reviewer, not mystery review. The review is going to be CZW's Tournament of Death 9.
Oh, my God. Just in time for Halloween.
Exactly. We're going to see a Tournament of Death. So
Tournament of Death 9. Is this a recent one? What era of CZW are we talking about?
The exact date, for those of you that want to watch this, and you can do so on YouTube, it is available. The entire thing is available here.
I'm going to assume a table spot off of the turnbuckle to the floor is not going to be the biggest spot of the match.
You don't know, Wei. You're assuming right now. Number 9. Here we go. From June the 26th. Of 2010.
Okay, cool.
So we're going back 6 years.
Who's a part of this tournament?
We have Masada, Devin Moore, JC Bailey, Danny Havoc, Nick Gage, Dysfunction. These are all some of the people competing in the Tournament of Death number 9. Tournament of Death 9 was held in Townsend, Delaware. Non-tournament matches were, well, I don't want to read the results here.
Had we done a CZW show on this thing before?
I don't think so.
Oh,
yes.
Wow. There you go. Our first CZW review. So I'm going to miss it.
Yeah. Well, you can listen, Wei. Yeah, you can feel free to watch along as
yeah,
well.
Maybe.
So that will be our next review, folks. You can check that out. And you can get all of our shows up at liveaudiowrestling.com. You can subscribe to Live Audio Wrestling so you can get all of our shows, no matter what the hosts or the content. They'll mm-hmm. all come your Wei. And thank you to all of you for leaving some feedback, some ratings for us on iTunes. It's greatly appreciated.
Do we have some iTunes ratings?
Yes, we got a bunch.
Oh, cool. Nice. Any notable ones that jump out?
Yeah, one asshole who thinks we're Wei too negative on Raw. So thanks very much, folks.
Go fuck yourself.
Asshole. But if you left us a positive one, then we like you.
Yeah.
If you didn't.
I mean, we still like you.
No.
It'd just be funny.
No, don't listen to us anymore.
No, just make fun of us in a funny Wei. I'll be fine.
So, Wei, you have a great series of trips mm-hmm. coming up. Should be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We will chat with you again in 2018 when you return from the road. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a very busy schedule for One Wei Ting. But we will be back. All of our shows will be happening in the absence of One Wei Ting, and he will have lots to discuss when he returns. At a faraway date as we start planning for the return Wei. Start airing some vignettes
Ooh,
for you.
Nice.
And your comeback. Cool. All right. Oh, and a programming note, folks. If you are listening to this in our archives months away, this means nothing. But if you're listening today on Friday, October the 14th, Bauer and Pollock is postponed this week until next week. Our schedules are just out of alignment. So there's no Bauer and Pollock this week. We will be back with a new show next Friday. So that will save you a number of tweets to me asking what has happened. So next week, we are back with that. And the Lost Sunday Night, Midnight Eastern, scheduled to be joined by Cody Rhodes on the show. So you can check that out. And that is all for us. Going out here, as I mentioned, this was a pay-per-view where a lot of the focus was on the fake Razor and Diesel. And I was just looking this up before we recorded. Here is the promo from Jim Ross. His semi-shoot promo on Vince McMahon and introducing the fake Razor and fake Diesel from September 23rd on a live edition of Raw.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, before I was so rudely interrupted with a commercial break, we're going to conduct this interview right now. And in just a couple of moments, I'm going to bring Big Daddy Cool Diesel and Razor Ramon right out here. But before I do, I'd like to just beg your indulgence for just a minute or so and tell you something that I've got on my mind. There's something I've been waiting to say for a long, long time. And when I'm through telling you, many of you are going to question my loyalty to the World Wrestling Federation. So let's clear that up right now.
What are you talking about? I have no idea.
I have no loyalty to the World Wrestling Federation. I've only got loyalty to good old JR. Let me tell you why. In 1993, I left a great job in Atlanta, Georgia. And I left the Atlanta Falcons of the National Football League to go to the recognized leader of sports entertainment, the WWF. And I came here to be the primary play-by-play man in the WWF. I don't think anybody here is going to disagree that I'm the best play-by-play man in the whole damn business.
What's he doing? I really don't know. This is
so I show up for work the first day at WrestleMania 9 in Las Vegas, Nevada, and they give me a sheet to wear. They said, oh, it's going to be a toga. You'll look good in a toga, JR. I lead the National Football League for a toga. It's crap. And then, ladies and gentlemen, I go to the first King of the Ring in Dayton, Ohio. And I guarantee you, you listen to that broadcast. I carried the broadcast from ringside. And then did you ever wonder where old JR went to? Why isn't JR doing play-by-play anymore? Let me tell you why. Because the egotistical owner of the World Wrestling Federation, and you know what I'm talking about Vince McMahon, couldn't stand the competition.
Why is he doing this? This is rather unfortunate.
So JR disappeared. And then on Super Bowl Sunday in 1994, I woke up with an affliction called Bell's palsy. And my entire left side of my face looked like I had a stroke. You think I like that? You think I like that my left eye doesn't open all the way because I got sick? Let me tell you how warm-hearted Mr. McMahon is. Mr. McMahon called me into his office on February the 11th, 1994, and he fired my ass. So I get back in my car, and I'm driving to my home in that overpriced hellhole, Connecticut, and I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to tell my wife and my two little girls that their daddy had just got fired. And so then, remember when McMahon got indicted? They needed somebody to come back and do Raw. They called OJR. And then they let me go again. So finally they called me back. Hired me back for 50 cents on the dollar to come back and work in the front office. Do you think that all these guys leaving the WWF was an accident? Hell no, it's not. You think all these guys coming here was an accident? Absolutely not. I've been very busy. And right now, I want to bring back one of your favorites. He's the bad guy, Razor Ramon.
Bad guy, man.